From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And we lifted Sally up. But my neighbor shouted, her legs are gone. I can't describe what it's like looking at your daughter, carrying her in your arms covered in blood, and her legs are not there.
A father describing what happened to his 10-year-old daughter in Iraq. Her legs were blown off in a U.S. airstrike. Today, they join us in studio, along with the man who brought them to the United States. Then, real bad Arabs, how Hollywood vilifies a people.
Islamophobia now is a part of our psyche. Words such as Arab and Muslim are perceived as threatening words. And if the words are threatening, what about the images that we see in the cinema and on our television screens?
We'll speak with media critic Jack Shaheen. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, more than 130 people have been killed in an apparent suicide bombing targeting the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Bhutto's convoy was attacked just hours after she returned from 8 years in exile. It was the deadliest attack in Pakistan's history. Hundreds of thousands of people had lined the streets of Karachi to celebrate Bhutto's return. Bhutto has vowed to restore democracy to Pakistan, yet is returning as a likely ally of President Pervez Musharraf, who seized power in a coup. Earlier in the day, Bhutto denied deal-making behind the scenes.
People have said that my talks with General Musharraf is based on a power-sharing deal. There is no power-sharing deal. My discussions with General Musharraf have been on how to move the country towards civilian leadership and towards a restoration of democracy, towards national reconciliation. And while there has been some small progress, there's a lot more yet that needs to be done.
The second and final day of confirmation hearings for Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey were held Thursday. Mukasey drew criticism from Senate Judiciary Committee members for testifying he believes President Bush could ignore rules mandating that a special surveillance court approve all secret wiretaps. Mukasey also refused to say if he believes the controversial interrogation technique known as waterboarding amounts to torture. Leading Democratic and Republican Congress members are calling on the Bush administration to apologize to Maher Arar for his wrongful imprisonment and torture. Arar is the Canadian citizen seized by U.S. officials during a stopover flight in New York in 2002. He was secretly sent to Syria as part of the Bush administration's extraordinary rendition program. In Syria, Arar was held for almost a year in a grave-like cell and repeatedly tortured. He was released without ever being charged with a crime. On Thursday, Arar testified to the House Judiciary and Foreign Affairs Committees by video conference because he remains barred from entering the United States. The Bush administration maintains Arar poses a national security threat. Democratic Congressmember Gerald Nadler of New York said he reviewed Arar's confidential file and found the government has no evidence against him. Nadler said, quote, "This was a kidnapping. There is nothing there to justify the continuation of this campaign of vilification against you or to deny you entry into this country." Republican Congressmember Dana Rohrabacher, a backer of the administration's rendition program, added, quote, "I join in offering an apology, and I wish our government could join me in doing this officially," he said. The Canadian government has awarded Maher Arar $10 million. The House has failed to override President Bush's veto of a bill expanding health insurance to millions of children from low-income families. Supporters needed a two-thirds majority to overcome the veto, but not a single Republican who initially voted against the measure switched sides. The bill would have expanded the state children's health insurance program, known as SCHIP, by $35 billion over 5 years. Democratic leaders say they'll reintroduce the measure with minor changes next month. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmember Pete Stark has set off a furious Republican reaction with his comments on the House floor. Stark said, quote, "You don't have money to fund the war or children, but you're going to spend it to blow up innocent people if we can get enough kids to grow old enough for you to send to Iraq to get their heads blown off for the president's amusement." Stark has refused to apologize. In other news from Washington, D.C., a measure recognizing the Armenian genocide appears headed for failure. The House Foreign Affairs Committee approved the resolution last week, but dozens of lawmakers have withdrawn support following an outcry by the Turkish government. This is Democratic Congressmember John Murtha.
I must have had 25, 30 members, Democrats, come to me yesterday and say, you know, very agitated about this coming to the floor right now. They have gotten the message. So I would say if it were to run today, it wouldn't pass.
The Bush administration has lobbied against the bill, saying it would harm relations with an important Mideast ally. In Iraq, three civilians have been wounded in a shooting from a British private security firm. Guards from Erinis International are said to have opened fire on a crowded taxi. It was the third known shooting of Iraqi civilians by a private company in the past month, beginning with Blackwater's killing of 17 people in Baghdad. In Burma, the UN World Food Program is warning an estimated 5 million people are lacking enough food. Burma's food crisis has worsened during the military junta's crackdown on a pro-democracy uprising. But World Food Program Asia Regional Director Tony Bambury said a shortfall in international funding is also to blame.
Humanitarian assistance from WFP and other aid organizations can only be a Band-Aid. And the sad thing is, or one of the many sad things is, that right now the world's not even to pay for that, not even willing to pay for that Band-Aid.
In Argentina, a landmark trial has opened into human rights abuses at the military dictatorship's main prison during the so-called Dirty War. Thousands of dissidents were tortured at the Navy School of Mechanics, known as ESMA, for 7 years, beginning in 1976. Victims will give closed-door testimony against former Navy officer Hector Febres, who is being tried for torture. Former prisoner Enrique Fuchman said the trial has raised mixed emotions.
They're not even going to try him for kidnapping the people he tortured. So it's a mix of saying, well, we've taken another step forward, but we're really angry.
In Britain, a parliamentary committee is investigating long-held allegations the CIA has maintained a secret prison on the island of Diego Garcia. The Guantanamo Bay Prisoners Legal Defense Group, Reprieve, says Diego Garcia has hosted one of a number of so-called black sites for U.S. prisoners overseas. The U.S. has operated a military base there since British forces expelled Native Islanders in the early 70s. An American professor who won the Nobel Prize for co-discovering the structure of DNA is drawing criticism for claiming black people are less intelligent than whites. Dr. James Watson was set to deliver a speech at the London Science Museum in Britain, but the appearance was canceled after Watson's response to a question on Africa's long-term future was published in a British newspaper. Watson said, quote, "All our social policies are based on the fact that their intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says not really." Watson's research lab, the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, has suspended him over his comments. China has summoned its U.S. ambassador in protest of a congressional award to the Dalai Lama. The exiled Tibetan spiritual leader was given the Congressional Gold Medal, the nation's highest civilian honor, at a ceremony this week. In campaign news, new figures show Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton has emerged as the candidate most favored by the nation's leading weapons companies. Clinton has received more than $52,000 from arms industry employees. That's more than half the amount given to all Democratic candidates and 60% of the total that's gone to Republicans. And the photographer Ernest Withers has died. Withers was one of the most prominent photographers to come out of the civil rights era. He photographed Dr. Martin Luther King at several marches and was the only photographer to cover the entire trial of those accused in the murder of the black teenager Emmett Till. Last January, I interviewed Ernest Withers at his studio in Memphis, Tennessee. He talked about one of his most famous pictures, a mass of striking sanitation workers holding signs reading, "I am a man," at what would turn out to be the last march led by Dr. Martin Luther King.
The last march of Martin King, they were lined up there at Pontotoc and Hernando outside of Cleveland Temple Church, and they were there with all those "I'm a man" signs. And it was traumatic and historic and what it was, but I didn't know it was ending up to be as, you know, as popular, but it was the last march of Martin King.
That was the late Ernest Withers. He died this week at the age of 85. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, three Iraqi civilians, including a journalist, were wounded Thursday when guards from the private British security company Aranis opened fire on a taxi near the city of Kirkuk. The British company is in Iraq under a contract with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Injured in the attack was a female journalist who worked at the Kurdish TV station Zagros. Well, today we're going to closely look at the issue of civilian casualties in Iraq. We'll be joined in our studio by a 10-year-old Iraqi girl named Sally Alawi. Last year, she lost both of her legs in a U.S. airstrike. The same attack killed her 13-year-old brother and her best friend. Sally's sister was also injured. Unlike most Iraqis injured since the U.S. invasion, Sally has been given a rare opportunity to travel to the United States for medical care. Today, she's learning how to walk again thanks to the organization No More Victims. The group brought her here last December to receive a pair of prosthetic legs. Sally will join us in studio in a few minutes with her father. But first, we turn to Cole Miller, founder of No More Victims, who brought her to the United States. How did you learn about Sally's story, Cole, and how did you get her here?
Well, I first learned about Sally when a man by the name of Maki Nizal got in touch with me from Fallujah and said, there's a little girl. I was actually working then to bring another child to Boston, who was there getting treatment now, little Omar. And he got in touch with me and said, there's a little girl, and her legs are cut, and she's in an abandoned building without heat with her family. And she's shivering. She needs an emergency operation in Sulaymaniyah. Can we help? And so I sent a little bit of money. I said, of course we can help. We sent a little bit of money, and she got heating oil and blankets and then was evacuated to Sulaymaniyah, where she had that operation. So that's how I learned about her. In terms of getting her to the United States, the way that I work, we want to provide people of conscience in the United States with ways of taking direct, independent action to help victims of this war. And I got an email a couple of years ago from a woman named Ann Cothran in South Carolina, and she said she wanted to bring a child to South Carolina. And so I took the medical report and I sent it to her, and she went to Shriners Hospital in Greenville, the most conservative city and probably the most conservative state in the nation. And they said, sure, we'd be happy to help this girl. And once I had the letter promising pro bono treatment, I just put into place the procedures to get her here. So we arrived on July the 8th. The entire community of Greenville really reached out to her, and the people there got a lesson in what it means to bomb civilian areas. And what was shocking was so many people in South Carolina seemed to be simply unaware that children were being hurt in Iraq. And that's, of course, a pretty profound criticism of the mainstream media.
You're taking this all over the country.
Yes, all over the country. We have three basic ways of working. And the premise is if you are opposed to what's happening, find one person who's been hurt and do everything in your power to help them. And much will flow from that. The three ways that we work, first, we evacuate children who can benefit from medical treatment in the United States, unavailable in Iraq, and benefit significantly from treatment here. And then we set up these projects working with communities in the United States. Another way we work is we deliver medical supplies directly to clinics and hospitals. You know, the Oxfam report said 80%, I believe it was, of Iraq's hospitals are without the most basic supplies. So that's another way that we work. A third way, and a very exciting way that we work, is we set up advocacy projects where we connect a high school group or a college group or a community group, church group, with individual children whose injuries are beyond medical remedy, but who are still not getting their needs met in Iraq. And it works particularly well in high schools and in colleges. They put together a project. I connect them with a photograph, a medical report, and facts about what happened to the child. And then their job is to, you know, seek all the information they can. I help to facilitate that, to find out what kind of services are available to the child, the date and time of the attack, the number of civilians killed, so they can begin gathering the information themselves. Then they put together a needs assessment, and on the basis of that needs assessment, they go to work to help the child. So they identify the child's most pressing needs, and then they have bake sales or car washes to raise money. Now, a group in Boston, a group of high school students, while I was in Amman to get Omar out, sent me an email saying that they had raised $1,200 for a little girl named Shaima. Now, Shaima is from Fallujah, and in the April siege, there was a horrific attack where 31 people were killed, including 17 children. She was only 6 months old at the time, and a shrapnel is buried in her spine. It permanently paralyzed her from the waist down, and there's no medical remedy. So these kids found out about her, sent her a letter. We had it translated and sent her. Then we received back responses from her grandfather, who is her caretaker now. And they decided that the thing she most needed was a wheelchair, which was not available to her in Fallujah. And so I got from the Al Hussein Society in Jordan. They actually gave me a wheelchair, and I made a $150 donation. And we shipped that wheelchair to Shaima. So there's a picture at the website, which is www.nomorevictims.org. There's a picture of the high school group and Shaima sitting in the wheelchair that they got for her.
And the other high school kids around the country who were involved with your whole project?
Yes, from San Diego to Orange. There's a group that looks like it's forming in Seattle. Boston College has become involved. It looks like there's a project at Northeastern. We're probably going to put together another advocacy project in South Carolina. There's one in Florida. They're basically going all over the country. And this is... bringing a child here is obviously very heavy lifting on the part of a lot of people, and we're going to continue to do that where it's indicated and where we can put the setup together. But this can reach out really broadly. Every community in the United States could do this. You know, just connect yourself with the child, find out what happened to that child, and then advocate for that child. And what I would love to do at some juncture is to get a bunch of these kids together who have been working to help and take them to Washington, and they'll go in with a photograph and a medical report and facts about what happened, and they can meet with their senators and congressmen and say, here's what we're doing to try to help this child. How is it that this child, after we have hurt this child, cannot get help in Iraq?
We're going to go right now to Sally. To the 10-year-old girl.
She's a lovely
Cole
child.
Miller, I want to thank you for being with us. No More Victims is the organization that Cole has founded, nomorevictims.org. As we turn now in a moment, Sally Alawi will join us in studio. But I first want to turn to a short video produced by No More Victims. It features Sally and her dad retelling what happened on the day of the U.S. airstrike in Iraq.
We were just sitting there, completely unaware. Hijran asked, "What's that black thing coming towards us?" So we all stood up. And I said to Tabarak, "Let's go." It made a sound like whoosh. Hijran had already run to a pile of bricks. It fell right in the middle of us. I fell through the air towards the same pile of bricks. I grabbed onto them right away.
Just like we're sitting here now, we were just sitting there stirring our tea, as I remember. Just stirring tea. Suddenly we were thrown in the air, and there was dust and smoke and blood and pieces of flesh on the walls that are still there now. It was a strong blast. Some of us ran into the house overcome by terror. In our fear, we had forgotten that the children were outside and they had only been 3 or 4 meters away from us.
It fell right in the middle of us, and it made a circle in the street. Rasul was carrying her sister's teddy bear, and it got all dirty.
I asked if anyone was hurt because all of our clothes were stained with the blood and flesh that had sprinkled over the fence. We heard screaming and we ran back outside. Akram and Tabarak were scattered in pieces across the ground. I looked around for Sally, who was 30 or 40 feet away, sitting on her knees, calling for me and her mother. It looked like there was nothing wrong with her body. Then our neighbor said, "Come quickly," and I ran with my wife and she cried out, "My daughter," and we lifted Sally up. But my neighbor shouted, "Her legs are gone. I can't describe what it's like looking at your daughter, carrying her in your arms covered in blood, and her legs are not there."
Uncle Hamid, all of us were wearing jackets. He was wearing his jacket too. And the poor guy had to use it to pick up body parts.
Who was there for the airplane to shoot at? Who was there for them to shoot at?
There was me. There was me, Rasul. There was me, Rasul, Tabarak, Akram, and Hijran.
Was there anyone else?
No.
What were you doing?
Playing hopscotch.
In a moment, Sali Alawi and her father will join us live here in our Firehouse studio in New York. But first, the break. Song Ave Maria here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Sali Alawi now joins us in Firehouse Studio. Last December, she lost both her legs in a U.S. airstrike. The same attack killed her 13-year-old brother and her best friend. We're also joined by Sali's father, Hussein Alawi Faris. He works as a foreman at a pickle factory in Iraq. After nearly 4 months of medical treatment in South Carolina, they're preparing to return to Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Sali, you're wearing lots of jewelry. Can you talk about where you got it from?
This
is Georgian.
This is from Georgia?
This is Georgian. This is South Carolina.
And this is from South Carolina?
This is Georgian. This is South Carolina.
So they are all from South Carolina and...
So these are all from friends you've made here in the United States?
هاي كلها من الأصدقاء اللي أنتي سويتيهم صاروا عديش أصدقاء هنا أنا؟ لمن أجيتي؟ من أصدقائك؟
Anna Cole.
Huh?
Anna Cole.
These are her best friends, Anne and Cole.
Uh-huh, from here. You have come here to America and have gotten new legs...
اجيت هنا لأمريكا وصاروا عندك أرجل مصطنعة. Yes.
How does it feel?
شلون تحسين؟ مثل بسين.
بس واحدة مرة هاي ما أقدر ألبسها.
It feels good. One of my legs just hurts so much, and so I think it's just infected. It hurts when I wear it.
Hussein, how has it been for you to come to the United States? Can you? We just watched the video where you describe what happened to Sali. Can you describe what you felt when you were invited to America?
احنا شفنا هسه الفيلم وحكينا عن اللي صار لسالي بس احكي لنا عن شعورك لما اجيت لامريكا شنو اللي حسيته
صراحه يعني انا اول كلام ابدي
honestly I want to start with
اشكر جدا الشعب الامريكي الصراحه اللي هو طيب اللي
I thank very much the good American people.
معلومة يعني متأخر عرفناها لما اجينا لأمريكا يعني صراحة.
It is a very late information that we learned that the American people are good people.
يعني من قساوة الجيش الأمريكي بالعراق تشوفي يعني ما
Because the US military is so harsh, they didn't leave us any time.
يعني ما خلى الشعب الأمريكي كل اسم أمريكي صار فد رعب لكل شخص بالعراق.
To feel that there are still good people in the U.S. that we just felt that everyone in the U.S. is like the American army.
صراحة من جيت لأمريكا باوعت الناس مهتمة بسالي وبغير سالي.
But honestly, when I came to the U.S., I just saw a lot of people who were very interested to help Sally and other than Sally.
يعني شيء ولا دخل دماغي يعني صراحة.
I couldn't believe it.
اختلاف كبير يعني احنا مع الاسف اللي كنا نحكم عليه يعني الشعب الامريكي يعني
Alas, we had a very bad impression on the people in the US.
والجند الامريكي كان عندنا سوء يعني مع الاسف يعني هذا اللي اتندم عليه انا يعني مع الاسف اقول هاي بس.
The American soldiers, alas, are really harsh on us.
You lost, well, your daughter lost her legs, her best friend. You lost your son.
أنت خسرت ابنك استشهد وبنتك راحت رجلها وصديقة بنتك همينة صح؟
نعم.
Yes.
In that attack.
نفس الهجوم.
نفس الحادث.
Yes, the same incident.
And your other daughter.
وبنتك اللخة.
نعم رجلها تنبتر يعني اليمنى لازم تنبتر يعني التهاب قوي باقي منها شيء جزء بسيط يعني.
Yes, one of her legs has to be cut off.
Sally, what do you tell American children about what happened to you?
إذا تريدين تدزين رسالة للأطفال بأمريكا اللي هم بعمرك شو تريدين تقولي لهم؟ ها؟ I want to tell them thank you.
Are you going back to Iraq, Sally?
راح ترجعين للعراق.
Are you afraid to go back?
ما خايفة ترجعين للعراق؟
No.
No, I'm not afraid.
How do you feel about going back, Hussein?
وأنت شنو إحساسك برجعتك للعراق؟
والله تعرفين أنت يعني مثل ما يقول جسدي هنا وقلبي بالعراق.
As you know, my body is here, but my soul is over there.
ما أتصور يصير بعد أزيد من اللي صار هذا.
And I don't think worse things are going to happen in Iraq.
What was your experience with the U.S. military before the air attack?
بالنسبة لتجاربك شنو اللي شفته من الجيش الأمريكي قبل هذا الحادث؟
ماكو شيء يعني فشيء حلو ينحكي.
There is nothing good to tell.
يعني يعني بضربة سالي ورا شهرين يعني ورا من ضربة سالي جيش الأمريكي قصف عشوائي على المنطقة.
2 months after the incident where Sally was injured, again random shooting started to happen in the neighborhood.
يعني الساعة بثلاثة بالليل تقريبا.
At 3 in the morning one night.
الدبابة تضرب بيت والعائلة نايمة بيه بثلاثة بالليل يعني.
A tank was firing at a house while people were sleeping inside.
والسقف يوقع على العائلة كاملة بأكمل من فراغ.
And I saw the roof of that house collapsing on the people inside.
ونجي على البيت نحفر شق احنا 11 ساعة تقريبا نحفر بالشق.
We spent 11 hours to dig through the wrecks, trying to, you know, to find someone who's alive. Because we heard someone's voice who was still alive.
لقينا سبع نفرات يعني منتهين من ضمنهم الأب والأم.
7 people out of 8 were killed in that attack.
ونفر واحد طلعناه 4 شهور وهسه هو عايش بالفلوجة.
Only one baby who was 4 months old, who was alive, and we were able to get him outside, and he's still alive, and now he's in Fallujah.
يعني هاي أحد يعني هاي واحدة من مئات الآلاف المصائب اللي يشوفها العراقي.
This is one of the hundreds of thousands of the incidents and miseries Iraqis face every day.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Where do you return when you go back to Iraq? What city?
تقول بالنهاية أشكرك شكر جزيل وأرد أسألك وين راح ترجع هسه من رجعتك لعراق بأي مدينة راح تكون؟
للفلوجة إن شاء الله.
تفلوجة.
بس عندي كلام أنا بس أريد أحكي إذا تسمح لي.
But if you allow me to say some words.
ممكن؟
Yes.
طبعاً أنا أولاً يعني شكر العميق لأخويا ويعني ومنقذ حياه سالي هو كول ميلر.
I am very grateful to my brother and to the best person, my brother Cole, who helped bringing life back to Sally.
صراحة سالي اعتبرها ولدت اليوم يعني بأمريكا من اجت لأمريكا ولدت ولادة جديدة يعني سالي ما أي عوق ما عندها.
For me, honestly, Sally was born again when she came to the U.S.
يعني حتى ولو الشعب الأمريكي إذا ما عنده ذيك الحرية وذيك الديمقراطية اللي يحكون عليها وما يقدر كل شيء يحركون ساكن بالعراق يعني يدعمون هالشخص هذا.
Even though people in the U.S. cannot really help to end the situation in Iraq, I would like everyone to help this person call.
لأن هذا عمل إنساني يعني صراحة ما أظن واحد يعني يخالفني الرأي بهذا.
I don't think anyone can object me on this. This is a humanitarian action.
يعني كول أنا متهجر من بغداد وأنا بعدني ما جايبني لهنا يعني للأمريكا. يبعث لي أنا كنت ألزم الكتب أحرقها على مود أدف سالي ورسل العائلة لأن ما عندي متهجر من بغداد أنا إلى الفلوجة.
When I was forced to leave my home, when I was displaced, Cole used to send me money while I was setting books and board
books.
Just like to, you know, to have some warmth in the house.
المعجزة عندنا يشيل 5 لترات نفط بل بالشتاء ويشيلها. فشيء غريب يعني.
And at that time it was a miracle if someone saw someone else carrying 5 liters of fuel.
وكول ده يسوي بنفس اللحظة يعني شو يسوي الجيش الأمريكي بالعراق؟ يعني إحنا هسه أنا بإحساسي أحس كول ده يدفع ضريبة عن الجيش الأمريكي اللي ده يصير بالعراق يعني أحس بي.
I just feel that Cole is paying taxes, is paying what the U.S. military is doing in Iraq.
فيستاهل الدعم هذا صراحة يعني وكل الشكر إليه والشعب الأمريكي الطيب صراحة يعني.
He deserves to be supported and I thank very much the American people.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us.
Thank
Have
you.
A safe trip back to Iraq. Hussein Alawi Ferris, father of Sally and Sally Alawi. Thank you both for joining us. We're going to turn right now to the images, the human images of Arabs and Arab Americans. Where are they? That's the topic of a new film called Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People. It's based on a book by the same name by acclaimed media critic Jack Shaheen. Both the book and the film explore the American cinematic landscape to reveal a stark pattern of Arab stereotyping and its disturbing similarity to anti-Semitic and other racist caricatures through history. In a little while, we'll be joined by Jack Shaheen, but first I want to play some excerpts of the film version of his book. It's directed by Sut Jolly. The New York premiere happened this week at the Cinema East Film Festival on Thursday.
Years I've looked at how we, particularly when I say we, image makers, have projected Arabs on silver screens. In my latest book, Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People, I looked at more than 1,000 films. Films ranging from the earliest, most obscure days of Hollywood to today's biggest blockbuster. And what I tried to do is to make visible what too many of us seem not to see, a dangerously consistent pattern of hateful Arab stereotypes. Stereotypes that rob an entire people of their humanity. All aspects of our culture project the Arab as villain. That is a given. There is no deviation. We have taken a few structured images and repeated them over and over again.
You are hostages of the Holy Freedom Party.
Whether one lives in Paducah, Kentucky, or Wood River, Illinois, we know basically the same thing.
Listen to the sound,
Jesus,
of Altar!
We know the mythology. The mythology, namely Hollywood's images of Arabs. We inherited the Arab image primarily from Europeans. In the early days, you know, maybe 150 years, 200 years ago, the British and the French who traveled to the Middle East, and those who didn't travel to the Middle East, conjured up these images of the Arab as the Oriental other. The travel writers, the artists who fabricated these images and who were very successful, as a matter of fact. And these images were transmitted and inherited by us. We took them, we embellished them, and here they are.
When you cross the mountains of the moon into our country, Mr. Jerome, you will be stepping back 2,000 years.
We have this fictional setting called Arab Land, a mythical theme park. And in Arab Land, you know, you have the ominous music, you have the desert. We start with the desert, always the desert as a threatening place. We add an oasis, palm trees, a palace that has a torture chamber in the basement. The Pasha sits there on his, you know, posh cushions with harem maidens surrounding him. None of the harem maidens please him, so they abduct the blonde heroine from the West who doesn't want to be seduced. When we visit Arab Land, we must be aware of the instant Alibaba kit. What we have the property masters of Hollywood going around, and they're cladding the women in see-through pantaloons, belly dancing outfits. They're giving the Arab villains scimitars, you know, these long, long scimitars. We see people riding around on magic carpets, turban charmers programming snakes in and out of baskets. Yesteryear's Arab Land is today's Arab Land.
You are late.
1,000 apologies, oh patient one.
You have it then.
I had to slit a few throats, but I got it.
Disney's Aladdin was seen by millions of children worldwide. It was hailed as one of Disney's finest accomplishments. But the film recycled every old degrading stereotype from Hollywood's silent black and white past.
Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place, where the caravan camels roam, where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home.
Where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. Now, how could a producer with a modicum of intelligence, just a modicum of sensitivity, let a song such as that open the film? 300 movies, nearly 25% of all Hollywood movies that in one way or another demean Arabs, contain gratuitous slurs, or they portray Arabs as being the butt of a cheap joke.
We were going into Mecca, see, and the plane is full of Arabs with these animals. Goats, sheep, chickens. I mean, they don't go anywhere without their goddamn animals. We had to put plastic in the cabins. You know, they urinate, they defecate.
You have films by Neil Simon, like Chapter 2. The beginning of the film, the protagonist arrives back from London, and his brother says, "How was London?" And he says, "Full of Arabs."
"How was London?" "Full of Arabs."
Well, imagine if he had said, "Full of blacks, full of Jews, full of Hispanics." I mean, that's ridiculous. Why do we do these things?
We got a bite.
One of the most offensive films with the gratuitous images, Father of the Bride 2. It features Steve Martin selling his house to a Mr. Habib.
"Justin, we like house very much. When you can move out?"
"Excuse me?"
"The Habibs would like to buy the house, George. It's exactly what they've been looking for."
"It's when you can move. We need house a week from Wednesday, and my wife wants flour dishes in kitchen. You sell, we pay top dollar."
When Habib's submissive wife tries to speak, he shouts gibberish at her. And then he offers Martin a $15,000 cash bonus to move out in 10 days.
Making real estate history here, George.
When Martin tells Mr. Habib that he doesn't want to sell the house after all, he finds Habib's wrecking crew there, ready to demolish his beautiful home. And in a scene that calls to mind one of the most degrading stereotypes of the Jewish people, Mr. Habib demands an extra $100,000 to sell the house that he has owned for just a day back to Martin.
You want me to take out a loan on something I owned free and clear just 24 hours ago?
Well, that is up to you, George. Your path, your fence, your memories.
Now, if you looked at the other Father of the Bride films, Elizabeth Taylor, Spencer Tracy, there were no Arabs or Arab Americans. So why does Disney inject these horrific, sort of offensive characters in Father of the Bride Part 2? It's the same reason that in Gladiator, the slave traders who kidnap Russell Crowe and bring him back to Rome are Arabs.
Right.
I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, why does Hollywood inject Arabs, scenes of Arabs, and or slurs demeaning Arabs in movies having nothing to do with the Middle East? So you're sitting like I am, for example, watching Back to the Future.
Oh, my God.
About a mad scientist.
Tell me, I don't know how.
And yet, early on in the film, we see these ugly, inept Libyans with machine guns in a parking lot trying to gun down the protagonist. I mean, why?
Yelanik! 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 No!
This movie wasn't about the future. It was the same old stereotyping from the past. And the same goes for Hollywood's view of Arab women. The Arab woman today is bright, intelligent. She's someone who is exceeding in all professions. And yet this reality still is being denied us on silver screens. The highly sexualized belly dancer has been with us from the beginning of Hollywood's history, inspired by early images of the Orient as the place of exoticism, intrigue, and passion. But in recent years, this image has dramatically changed. The Arab woman is now projected as a bomber, a terrorist. Added to this image is what I call bundles in black. Veiled women in the background, in the shadows, submissive. It seems the more Arab women advance, the more Hollywood keeps them locked in the past. Politics and Hollywood's images are linked. They reinforce one another. Policy enforces mythical images. Mythical images help enforce policy. Jack Valente, president of the Motion Picture Association of America, has said, quote, "Washington and Hollywood spring from the same DNA," end quote. The Arab image began to change immediately after World War II. There were three things that impacted the change. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict, in which the United States has unequivocally supported Israel. The Arab oil embargo in the 70s, which angered Americans when gas prices went through the ceiling. And the Iranian Revolution, which increased Arab-American tensions when Iranian students took American diplomats hostage for more than a year. These three pivotal events brought the Middle East into the living rooms of Americans and together helped shape the way movies stereotyped Arabs and the Arab world. One of the primary changes, the image of the Sheikh. In a movie such as Rollover, he's out to take over the world with his money, or he's up to no good trying to buy chunks of America.
Mrs. Winters, I think I should tell you there are those in the family who do not think we should be making this offer at all. I assume if you could have found venture capital of this sort for a company like Winterchem in America, you would not be coming all the way to Arabia looking for it.
You see the oily Sheikh in Spielberg's Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. You see the money-grubbing Sheikh who's out to commit all kinds of terrorism and launch a missile in earnest in the army.
Gentlemen, behold my special club, the Pluton missile. With it, I will bring the infidels to their knees and be leader in the Arab world.
One of the myths in the 70s was that the Arabs are coming over, buying up chunks of America. And of course, this was reflected in the cinema.
The Arabs have taken billions of dollars out of this country, and now they must put it back!
One of my favorite movies of all time, racist though it may be, is Network, about commercial television.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it. How do you feel?
We're mad as hell!
That evening,
network features a TV anchor rising to superstardom. How? He unleashes wild rants against the system on the air. But he directs the angriest of all his rants at Arabs, who he says are buying up America.
They're buying it for the Saudi Arabian Investment Corporation. They're buying it for the Arabs.
The anchor, Howard Beale, calls on the American people to rise up and stop the Arab buyout of his TV network.
Listen to me, goddammit. The Arabs are simply buying us. There's only one thing that can stop them. You.
The rage of Americans in response became one of the most famous scenes in movie history.
I want you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and write a telegram to President Ford saying, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
This kind of anger, the anger born of fear, all of it in response to a perceived conspiracy and threat by a specific group of people, well, we've seen and heard this before. If we look at the anti-Semitic propaganda of the Nazis, at its core is an identical type of economic threat. This economic myth even made its way into children's books. Sadly, the popular image of Jews in Nazi propaganda resembles the popular image of Arabs in some of our most beloved Hollywood movies, the only difference being that the Arab usually wears a robe and headdress. To solidify Washington's connection with Hollywood, simply look at the films produced in cooperation with the Department of Defense showing our men and women in the armed forces killing Arabs at random. Like Iron Eagle, where a teenager goes over and bombs up an Arab country. You know, just learns how to fly a jet overnight. And then, of course, Navy SEALs, where Charlie Sheen goes over to Lebanon and obliterates scores of Arabs.
All right, Chief. Let's go tag him and bag him.
Of all the Department of Defense films, the one that will stand the test of time as being the most racist is Rules of Engagement. The film was written by former Secretary of the Navy, James Webb. The action takes place in Yemen, a real country in the Middle East. There are violent demonstrations at the American Embassy, and the Marines, led by Samuel L. Jackson, they're called in to evacuate the American employees. And as they try to do so, the Marines open fire on the crowd and kill scores of Yemeni, including women and children. And in the investigation that follows, Tommy Lee Jones, the lawyer who represents the Samuel Jackson character, goes to Yemen to investigate. The movie leads us to believe what seems obvious, that the Marines committed this atrocity.
Armed American Marines, they were shooting at his people. They were just trying to defend themselves.
During his investigation, Jones's character sees a little girl with only one leg. He follows her, comes upon a hospital ward full of civilian victims. He finds an audio tape by the bed of one of the victims. And when the tape gets translated in court, we immediately begin changing our minds about who is responsible for this massacre.
To kill Americans and their allies, both civil and military, is duty of every Muslim who is able.
We discover that the Yemeni civilians aren't so innocent after all. It turns out they fired on the Marines first. And in a moment that will live in Hollywood infamy, we suddenly learn that the little girl we've been sympathizing with, the very girl whose humanity and innocence may have broken down our stereotypes, well, she's no better than those other Yemeni terrorists.
As a result, when Samuel L. Jackson delivers the key line, we're now on his side. Why does this matter? Because in the end, the massacre of even women and children has been justified and applauded. It's a slaughter, yes, but it's a righteous slaughter.
Sergeant Mack.
Sir?
Contact all stations. Mission complete.
The humanity is not there. And if we cannot see the Arab humanity, what's left? If we feel nothing, if we feel that Arabs are not like us, or not like anyone else, then let's kill them all. Then they deserve to die, right? Islamophobia now is a part of our psyche. Words such as Arab and Muslim are perceived as threatening words. And if the words are threatening, what about the images that we see in the cinema and on our television screens? We are at war with Iraq. We went to war in March of 2003. But didn't our entrance to the war, wasn't that made a lot easier, primarily because for more than a century we had been vilifying all things Arab? And now, given what happened with 9/11, the tragic events that took place on that day, where 19 Arab Muslim terrorists were responsible for the deaths of nearly 3,000 people, now, instead of saying that's the lunatic fringe, we say, no, 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 no. The actions reflect the actions of 1.3 billion people. Now, that's dangerous. We don't say that the actions of Ku Klux Klan members, who are Christians, represent Christianity, do we? Look at Oklahoma City. Timothy McVeigh, a good Irish Catholic boy. Do we say all Irish Catholics are terrorists? I mean, no one knew McVeigh's religious beliefs, where he went to church, or his ethnic background. It was not part of the story. Yet, of course, had that been an American with Arab roots, or an American Muslim, it would have been a part of the story. Remember that when news of the bombing broke, reporters and politicians, nearly everybody, rushed to judgment without any proof whatsoever.
A U.S. government source told CBS News that it has Middle East terrorism written all over it.
The attack in Oklahoma City appears to have a familiar mark.
This was done with the attempt to inflict as many casualties as possible. That is a Middle Eastern trait.
The fact that it was such a powerful bomb in Oklahoma City immediately drew investigators to consider deadly parallels that all have roots in the Middle East.
ABC News has learned that the FBI has asked the U.S. military to provide up to 10 Arabic speakers to help in the investigation.
The stereotype has become so widespread that it's become invisible to people. And the reason being is that we've all grown up with these images. Like, just look at television. We now have TV shows telling us that, in addition to the Arab terrorists over there, American Arabs over here are also terrorists. Then there's Showtime's Sleeper Cell. Here, a sinister network of Islamic groups operates on American street corners. Any homeless man could be part of this network. Even Western-looking Arabs are part of this anti-American conspiracy.
We're at war with America, period. And we're going to win that war by convincing enough Americans through the spread of fear, insecurity, and terror to change their ways. And the best way to teach that lesson is by attacking them where they live, work, and play.
And this paranoia runs deep. Just take a moment and flip through some of our most popular religious channels.
Islam, a religion of 2 billion members that's growing by 50 million people annually. Nearly every major terrorist network in the world is led by Islamic fundamentalists.
Islam is, as we have seen, a religion that teaches the violent subjugation of all non-Muslims. It promises paradise to terrorists and makes the vilest deed a thing of beauty in the eyes of Allah.
So when innocent Arabs are killed,
when they're bombed, maimed, wounded, when they're tortured in places like Abu Ghraib, is it really any surprise that we don't feel any compassion? Or worse, make light of it?
This is no different than what happens at the Skull and Bones initiation, and we're going to ruin people's lives over it, and we're going to hamper our military effort. You ever heard of emotional release? You ever heard of need to blow some steam off?
Well, yeah, sort of like, you know, a hazing, a fraternity prank, sort of like that kind of fun. But the point is, you know, everybody's been saying that this came from the top.
We don't care about them. We've been preconditioned to think that those innocent civilians, clones of Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, are one and the same and do not merit our sympathy, our understanding.
An excerpt of Real Bad Arabs, how Hollywood vilifies a people, featuring Jacques Shaheen, the award-winning media critic who wrote a book by the same title. In this last few minutes, he joins us live in our Firehouse studio. That film has just premiered in New York. Jack, the significance of the media.
Well, as Goebbels said, if you take the same images and you repeat them over and over again, and the images teach us to hate a people and to hate their religion, what happens is that we, in spite of our intelligence, our innate goodness, actually turn around and let these images despise and vilify an entire people. You just had a guest, a young Iraqi girl that lost both her legs as a result of a bombing in Iraq. If you look at Rules of Engagement, one of the films that I talk about in the book and in the movie, you see a Yemeni girl with one leg on a crutch who lost her leg when the Marine shot her. But in the end, this Yemeni girl is not a victim, but a terrorist. So we cannot empathize with this girl who walks around with a crutch. If you go and you see the new film called The Kingdom, Arab children again are portrayed as terrorists. So what's happening now is the trend has taken us to a point where we look at all those people, namely Arabs and Muslims, as the enemy other, even children. So when a young Iraqi girl loses both her legs, or there's a victim that takes place over in the Middle East that we don't see the suffering, we don't see the injury, and then even if we do, our hearts do not reach out for that victim, primarily because we've been taught by the media that those children are not to be trusted.
Jack, do you hold out any hope? We didn't get to the part of the film where you talk about images that you think are getting better. Overall, would you say it's worse or better?
Well, I think it's gotten much worse, and it's gotten much worse if you look at the film called The Kingdom, where Arabs drop like Cupid dolls in an amusement park.
By the way, I have hope. The film Jim Webb is the senator from Virginia.
I know. He wrote the story on which that film is based, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's featured in the documentary, the governor of California, we see him gunning down Palestinians in True Lies. So the link between politics and entertainment is there. I mean, media enforces policy, policy enforces media. They sort of scratch each other's back. I mean, it's a mutual sort of vilification society.
Well, we have to leave it there, but I look forward to your next book coming out in the next month called Guilty. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
Jack Shaheen, award-winning media critic. His book is Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People. The book is the same title as the film that has just premiered in New York. That ends it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Robbie Caring, Carrie Mache, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, our engineer. Special thanks also to Elizabeth Press, Haney Massoud, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chambly, Jose Miranda, Kieran Kruk Meadows, Travis Collins, Rakan Penny, Vesta Godars. I'll be tonight in Montreal at the Leacock Auditorium at McGill University. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.